7 minutes now past 10 o'clock. I'm Kara Lawrence. The 37th Annual Western Invitational Jazz Festival kicks off tonight with a concert with the Western Jazz Quartet and special guest George Garzon, who's coming to us today from the Boston area. It's wonderful to have you here, George. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
And we also have Andrew Rathbun, professor of saxophone at Western Michigan University. I assume you two know each other pretty well.
Pretty well.
Let's hear about getting to know how you guys got to know each other.
You want me to go?
Yeah, you go.
This is Andrew.
I studied with George at New England Conservatory in the 90s, and I went there specifically to study with him. Like, he's the reason I wanted to go to that school. I had a teacher in Toronto named Pat LaBarbera, who turned me on to George's music and his playing, specifically with this. We were talking about this. It's funny, we were talking about this car last night, this bootleg tape. It's called Cigar. It's called Cigar because George has this really famous trio called The Fringe, and they had a weekly residency at a club in Somerville, Mass. That was called The Willow. And somebody decided to light up a clove cigarette right in the middle of their set and started blowing the smoke up onto the stage. So there's just this ferocious, you know, groove going on. They're playing time, and George is playing over this, you know, sort of time, no changes thing. And it's just ferocious. And then suddenly the saxophone stops, and the bass and drums keep going. And he leans into the microphone and just excoriates this guy who's smoking this cigar. Like, you know, how dare you, you know. You're blowing that right in my face. I can't play. And then he goes back to playing. And then the level just goes up even higher. It just was, I just became obsessed with this tape. And I just had no idea what he was playing. But I wanted to find out. So I decided that I needed to go to Boston, you know, to find him and figure out what, you know, he was doing. So, and I'm still trying to figure it out. We all are.
Well, when you were growing up, Mr. Garzon, George, I'm guessing this is still like the heyday, maybe the post-romantic era of the great swing bands. Is that what you were listening to back then?
Pretty much, because I grew up in a saxophone family, and it's, you kind of nailed it. That's exactly what they were into, like, you know, big bands and the swing era and, you know, things like that. But they were very rooted in understanding what the saxophone was about and sound and all of that. And my uncle Rocco, who knew Joe Viola, who was the big saxophone guru at Berkeley back in, like, he started the place in 45-ish. It was still teaching when I went in 68, you know. And so they let me study in high school. I went to Boston Tech, which was like a tech school, but they let me go and study with Joe. So even while I was in high school, because he knew the family. So, you know, for me, like all my life, I was lucky enough to kind of happen into situations where, you know, being at the right place at the right time. But I really never wanted to teach, but just kind of got dragged into it, and I'm glad I did.
You know? What did you find out about yourself as a teacher?
that I could teach. I didn't think. I thought, you know, back then as a musician, you would play and you could make money playing. I mean, right after Berkeley, I went on the road with Tom Jones, and it was like this year of stardom with the private jet and, you know, all of this first class blah, blah, blah. One night we were hanging out with Elvis and, you know, Frank Sinatra and all these people. It was like, wow, this is the way it's going to be. And then they dumped me off back in Boston. And that was it, you know. So, you know, I was getting married and I had to figure out what I was going to do. And then the job came along at Berkeley, and it was like the thing to do. I mean, I could see that if you lived in Boston, you were either going to play weddings for the rest of your life, which I was doing anyway, or try to teach. And so I had to figure out what the balance was. You know, would it be playing or teaching? Or both, so I went for both.
You developed a technique or a vision for free jazz improvisation. I wonder where the change happened between the highly arranged, really road-mapped, big band material that was paying you, changed into this freedom, this ability to explore.
Well, there's a few answers to that, and this really, I really believe that the sound of the Fringe came from this situation. Back in the days when I was younger, I was able to play weddings with my family band by the time I was 12, so I was going out. And back then, they would go from tune to tune. They wouldn't stop so the people could keep dancing, and they would, like, throw fingers in the air for a key. Up is sharp, like two would be down, and they would barge from one tune to the other without stopping. And there was this moment of the clash of the key area. And I really believe that's where the Fringe was born, me listening to that crash until the key got adjusted, you know. And then, I mean, as far as me, you know, playing free, I met the drummer Galati in Berkeley, and he came, you know, just the normal come to the house and play. And we started playing and with the bass player, Rich Appleman. And then these guys were much more schooled on, like, Mingus and the Art Ensemble, Ornette Coleman. I had never heard any of that. And we started listening to that. And then slowly the tune, you know, the music went from playing Blue Bossa and Recordame to an extreme left. It took a sharp left turn and never came back.
Were you a proficient sight reader, or did you rely on your ear after a few times through a chart?
Well, I'm a pretty good sight reader. Like, if you know, it's like anything. If you don't do it, it takes you a minute to get into it. But, you know, I read enough all my life so that after a few charts, I, you know, kind of comes back. But, you know, I kind of, everything I've done in my life, I tried to make it sound like it's off the cuff, you know, like just, I mean, that to me is what improvisation is about. I spend a lot of time at Berkeley over the years. It's like trying to deprogram these guys because they, you know, they're so well versed at learning, you know, the scales and the chords, and then when they finish, they sound like that. But there needs to be one person in your life that turns that whole thing completely around, and that's my job.
Did you have an option to choose another instrument besides tenor saxophone?
Well, I play soprano, a little clarinet, but don't tell anyone. Lovano's the only one that once in a while he knows I play clarinet, and he used to call me for the Sinatra series that he did because there was a lot of clarinet in there. But I just really play tenor, soprano, little drums, very basic piano.
Yeah. Andrew, what was it like to learn from George Garzon?
I mean, again, it's such a huge part of my development as a musician.
Were you deprogrammed to an extent?
Yeah, like, yes. Yeah, it was almost like child abuse. I was so deprogrammed, you know. So he has some very strong ideas about like jazz phrasing and articulation. That's a huge. That was for me the first thing that we did was stop, you know, articulating every note. Every time you play a note, don't use your tongue to articulate it. So that took a really long time. That took like 2 months of just, you know, every day in the basement of the NEC practicing, trying to break this habit of like ta 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 ta, you know, just tonguing every single note. And then George's teaching style is this sort of great mix of you got to figure it out on your own, but I'll show you what I'm doing. So in the early stages, when I was studying with him, it was a lot of like he'd hand you these sheets with these chromatic lines that either were like very tightly woven intervals, and then eventually you'd get farther down the sheet and they would spread out, or he'd use like pentatonic scales or something. And he wouldn't say, you know, okay, I want you to practice A, B, C, and D. He'd just hand you this sheet and you'd play it with him, and then you'd play a tune and try and incorporate that into your playing. So a lot of it was like guided discovery, which I think is really the best way to learn, because if someone just like feeds the stuff to you like pablum, you don't develop any unique approach to that of your own, because you eventually you have to take the stuff and make it your own. You can't just, you know, ape the person who's feeding you this stuff. I think that's an important thing, and that's what makes you a real improviser, not just following someone else's instructions to the T, you know. And also another thing that's really important is you have to be at a certain stage to actually study with George. You have to have some foundation and fundamentals together before you go into all this wild stuff. And then what's happened since then is, you know, George has really developed this idea of this, chromatic triadic concept, where you're moving around triads and you're shifting between the triads by a half step. And it's pretty codified. It definitely is it's a stricter system. Would you agree?
When you're first learning it,
and then you kind of let go and you can use it how you want. But
this
I think
is
that's
a,
an
a
interesting
guide to improvisation.
Yeah, basically, yeah. It's basically almost improvising atonally, but using these different triads as these different color areas over top of something, either in a harmonic context or a non-harmonic context.
Deep.
It's hard to describe without demonstrating.
The real crux of it is when George employs it over a set of chord changes. I mean, there's really no one else who can do it like he can do it. And what's amazing is the fact that his interface between playing a harmonic scheme, because he can play the top to the bottom of a harmonic scheme without ever deviating from it, just play the snot out of it. But then he grafts these triads over top and he weaves his way in and out. I mean, when I studied with him, he said, you have to play harmony with one ear on the changes so you know where you are all the time, and the other ear on your line, and the line just drifts. You know, you hit the chord, you drift out of the chord. You hit the chord, you drift out of the chord. You know, so
I'm feeling that.
Yeah, and that's the way when he's in a situation where there's a, you know, a real strict harmonic scheme, that's how I envision how he plays. I hope he agrees.
I mean, to think back to when you were there, you know, 20 years ago at New England Conservatory, and you know, now, you know, to hear you still remembering all of that makes me realize that I was talking about that back then, which I thought happened a little bit later, but I guess maybe 95. You know, I was still putting it together, and I put a lot of this together on the blackboard at New England Conservatory, because I know it's bad, but I never really write anything down. I'm not like a, you know, someone who maps everything out, and I really... this phrase, you know, taught it to myself off on the cuff of writing it on the board in front of the kids and realizing, wow, you know, it's happening there, you know. But, you know, it's just something that came to me, you know, like I developed it. No one taught it to me. It was kind of shot into my mind in a Zen way. Because I live like that, you know, and I really trust it. A lot of people are afraid to trust the fact that you can live off of the air you breathe. Well, you do, you know. But when it comes to the music thing, you know, for me, it's become so formulated because of, you know, school and this and that. You know, there's got to be someone that you meet that can break you of all of this. You know, it's like when Rocky fought the Russian guy, and then that guy looks down at him. No, it's a little. And you know, and I had one student, and the Israeli clarinet player,
Anat
was so good. She was so good, and she just came out of the military from Israel, and every week she was just like busting my chops. And at one point I looked up at her and I was like the Rocky guy. I was like, Anat, I can break you. You know, she looked like she wanted to kill me, but, you know, I had to break her of these things that she was doing, you know, and there was so much resistance. You know, as far as torture and child abuse, no child abuse, but torture, yes, because I was tortured, so everyone else needs to be tortured. Okay. Musical torture.
Did you were tortured.
Did you see Andrew change as a player under your guidance?
Well, this is, you know, now I hear these guys. And, you know, like, they were getting their act together, and now, like, I come and hear these guys, you know, beautiful sound. He figured it out. You know, he figured it out. And I knew he would, as would everyone else. Eric Rasmussen from Phoenix. And I played a gig about a month ago with Seamus Blake and Chris Cheek, they were monsters even when they went to Berkeley. And, like, to hear these kids playing all this stuff that you would had fed to them back then, it's amazing. But, you could hear that they'll do it. You know, and it's interesting to see when they pop, you know, because you've got to stay at it. I mean, I'm still going at it and figuring out different things because it's endless. It doesn't stop, you know.
My guest is jazz saxophonist George Garzon, who is the special guest in the 37th Annual Western Invitational Jazz Festival. The opening concert is tonight at 8 o'clock in the Dalton Center Recital Hall. He'll be appearing with members of the Western Jazz faculty, including Jeremy Siskin, Keith Hall, Tom Kinnifick, Scott Cowan, and Andrew Rathbun, who's also here in the studio today, a former student of George Garzon and current professor of jazz saxophone at Western Michigan University. Andrew, what happens tomorrow for this festival?
Tomorrow we have, I'm going to get the numbers wrong, but no one will know. It's like 16 big bands and 13 combos that come through that perform for some panels, and we give them a little bit of feedback. And on Saturday evening, we invite the top high school big band and the top combo to appear in a concert. And then after that, George will be playing with the University Jazz Orchestra and playing some great arrangements of his music by this really superlative composer, Ayn Inserto, who also teaches at Berkeley. So she's arranged some of his music. They've done a number of records together. In fact, they just completed a new recording. I don't know when that'll be out, but it's really fantastic music. She was a student of Bob Brookmeyer's at New England Conservatory, and you can really hear that imprint in her music. So it's going to be a great evening of music.
Well, just to recap all of that, there's a concert tonight in the Dalton Center Recital Hall. George Garzon with the Western Jazz Quartet and faculty. All day tomorrow, high school bands performing in the Dalton Center, and a closing concert tomorrow night, 7:30, with the Western Jazz Orchestra featuring George Garzon. Why don't we take a break? Because I know there's a lot more stories to tell, but you need to, you know, replenish your energy. So let's hear some music. What do you suggest we hear from here?
From Fours and Twos, the Mingus that I knew.
And if you just tuned in, we are listening to music of George Garzon from the album Fours and Twos. That's the Mingus that I knew. George Garzon is visiting Kalamazoo here from Boston to perform in the Western Invitational Jazz Festival. Concert is tonight at 8 o'clock with members of the Western Jazz Quartet. And also here in the studio is the professor of jazz, Andrew Rathbun. Is this a tune that you wrote, the Mingus I knew?
Yes.
Did you know Charles Mingus?
Yes. Well.
What was he like? What was he like to know?
He was a rough customer. I don't think he liked me because, you know, when I was 20, I went to into the city, New York, with my friend to hear the Thad Jones Mel Lewis Band. It was like 1970. And that's, again, back when they were smoking, you know, and I'm very sensitive to smoke because I'm a very sensitive person.
He says with a smile.
And so all through the set, you know, it was, the place was packed, and someone was honking this huge cigar behind me. I don't know how they find me. And it was so tight, I couldn't, like, turn around or anything. And as soon as I turned around, I was like, man, who's smoking that cigar? And it was Mingus, and he just blew this big puff of smoke in my face. And that's how I wrote the tune for him.
It has a pretty mellow groove to it.
Well, it's like a subliminal message, you know?
What is how many albums have you worked on over the years, you think?
You know, you don't count because you lose count. But I would say for myself, probably five personal records with Mike Minieri's label, New York City Records. He's the one that really kind of put me on the map. And then, you know, like doing a record with Andrew, and then getting connected to a record label in Copenhagen, you know, different things. I don't know. It's a lot, you know.
It's in the hundreds, easily. I mean, if you add up the recordings with the Fringe, there's got to be at least 15, if not 20 Fringe recordings from the beginning of that group, which, as George mentioned, is probably 45 years going strong. Then, you know, he's got at least 10 or 12 recordings as a leader on his own, and then hundreds of recordings as a sideman. I mean, with everybody, you know.
Which doesn't even tell you how much or how often you are out there performing live. What is your, you know, day-to-day live performance schedule looking like?
It's nuts. You know, it's so much, right, Andrew? Yeah. It's so much that you don't think about it, because if you think about it, you'll have a freaking stroke. You know, like this lifestyle we lead. You know, my mother, who just passed in December, she grew up in a musical family. She was always like, I don't understand your life. Why do you run around like this? You go everywhere and, you know, you do all this stuff. I said, Mom, it's the life of a musician. You know, I said, be glad that I'm doing that and I'm not borrowing money from you, or I'm a drug addict. She just never understood it, but I think in the back she did, you know.
Did you try to set up a life where most of your performances could be in your hometown, your home area? I mean, you're working at a couple schools there, and you've got a standing gig in Cambridge at the Lily Pad. But are you often at the airport?
Yes, he's often at the airport. Every time we talk, he's at another airport, or he's in another in another country. You know, playing with people, because again, everyone wants a piece of this totally unique improvisational language and approach. So they call from far and wide, come to Australia, come to Denmark, come to Italy, you know. So he's constantly running from place to place because everyone wants a little piece of this, piece of the action.
How is your playing these days?
How
is your playing these days?
My playing? Good question. I feel like I'm going to another level, you know. I've always heard that after 60, that's when, you know, the mature jazz musician starts to really go forward. And that, I mean, I'm 66, but, you know, it's shooting forward, you know, and I never thought that, oh, it would stay in one place. I knew it would move and move, but I can see it going forward. Plus, you know, you got to keep up with these young tykes, and, you know, they got to get you on the bandstand and they try to kill you, you know, so you got to be able to dominate them. So it requires you to stay in shape, you know what I mean, like exercise and workout. And, you know, I mean, I love, it's a youthful thing, like playing with Seamus and Chris Cheek. These guys, you know, they know where to put it, you know, Andrew, they know where to put it. I mean, I gave it to them, but they went with it, you know, so You know, you're constantly trying to figure out, you know, where, how to keep it at this high level. A lot of it has to do with keeping yourself in shape because, you know, as you get older, if you're not in shape, you know, traveling around, playing, teaching, keeping this up, you know, it's very demanding. But as far as running around and playing, it's what we do. It takes a long time to understand that. This is what we do, you know. Plus, if you teach and, you know, like 20 years later, you have these guys like Andrew that have these jobs at these different schools and they're calling you to come in, you know, and it's great. It's, you know, it keeps you, you know, alive, moving, and young. As far as being in one place in a stable relationship, like I'd love to have, like coming to Andrew's house and seeing the kids and wake up in the morning and everything's normal. It's like, I really admire that. You know, I mean, I did that 20 years ago too, but now it's, you know, it's what it is.
So maybe you're, maybe you've been a little too busy to think about this sort of thing, but I wanted to ask a question and I need to explain with a little bit of backstory. I had a classical conductor here the other day. We started talking about who had lost an incredibly promising student to another discipline just because even as talented as she was, it just didn't look like there was a place for her out there. You're in a place where you're training some of the finest students to come along. The training that kids get these days is the best it's ever been, I've heard. You're turning out incredible players from schools, and then there are fewer and fewer places for them to play, to gig, to do things. Is that a disservice to this generation somehow?
Oh, I think it's, me personally, I think it's more challenging. You know, of course, there were more gigs when I was young, but it was the same thing. I mean, you could go out with Tom Jones. You could go out with Buddy Rich, which I did. You know, you could go out with Maynard Ferguson, but you've got to go out and suss it out. You know, you've got to look for it.
Do you have any thoughts on that, Andrew, as a teacher yourself?
Yeah, I mean, but I sort of give somewhat similar advice to you have to create your own scene and find your own, you know, group, your own peer group to make music with. And that just, you know, you can build something from that and generate something from that. And, you know, George really, he's like, man, you got to move to New York. You got to move to New York. And I was terrified. How am I going to survive in New York? And you find a way. You figure it out. I will agree that it's a lot more challenging. I mean, I even feel like the students that I teach that want to go to New York now, it's, I just can't imagine doing that. I mean, I went there in 98. I can't imagine trying to do it now. I mean, the cost of living there is just so incredibly expensive. But they figure it out. They find a way. You know, they go live way out in Bay Ridge or East New York, and they figure it out. So, you know, I guess our job as teachers is just try and give them as much equipment as we can to be successful, you know, musical and or otherwise. You know, prepare them for what they are about to confront, and hopefully they do it and are successful.
You know? I mean, I've had players like Francisco Mela, Peter Slavov. These guys, kids were asking me when they were in Boston, oh, should I move to New York? Should I move to New York? I was like, absolutely, because they were top-level players. And, you know, I pushed them to do it, and now Mela plays with McCoy Tyner. He plays with you know, all the top players, Slavov plays with Levano, and had they had not moved to New York, that wouldn't have happened, you know? So, you know, it's something, and it never dies. It might change a little bit, but you've got to push yourself to do these things, you know? No one gives you anything in music, you know? You've got to grab it, you know? It's like anything else. And if you don't grab it, then, you know, you might miss out on something that's really important, you know.
Again, the concert tonight starts at 8 o'clock in the Dalton Center Recital Hall. Do you know what you'll be playing tonight?
We're going to be playing some of George's original music. Some things from his records, a couple things from that Fours and Twos records, and some a smattering of his classic hits.
I'd like to hear more about the Fringe, these guys that you've played with for so long. I need a little character analysis of your drummer, Bob Gulati, or bassist, John Lockwood.
No, characters, that's the perfect word, you know. Well, I met Bob at Berkeley, and then he invited me to his house to play sessions. So we started playing, and again, we were doing back in, you know, like 71, 72, like Record MA, Blue Bossa. That was like, those were the Berkeley tunes. So we started playing, and you know, these guys could really play. And then all of a sudden, something happened, and the music took a left and never returned. And I think it was fate for this group to be together. You know, because the Fringe, it wasn't like we tried to keep it together, you know, buying band uniforms and a PA system. And it's like this, again, I believe that music decides what's going to happen for you. And the music, you know, said, okay, you three are going to stay together, because it's like 45 years later, we're still playing. And the music is just as ferocious as when we were, you know, I was 22, and now it's, you know, we're all like 66, 67, but it's just something that happened without trying, you know. It's like we didn't try to keep it together. You know, we've been through so many things, you know, mothers and fathers passing, everyone getting divorced, you know, like real humanistic things that happen in your life, you know, and like helping each other through. Jumping on the bandstand and going bananas, and then you know, these guys having a chance to come every week when they were in school to see this, and it's not like, oh, they're playing, you know, All the Things You Are, or they would play All the Things You Are and then completely tear it apart, and have them realize that you could play like this. You know, it was like, okay. I mean, it's completely risque music, but... Even if you're a non-musician, there's some thread in there that, you know, pulls you in. It drags you into the music, and we're still going. I mean, now at Berkeley and Boston at the Global Institute, Kenny Warner comes in, and Lovano Petitucci, and they usually teach on Mondays, and they're like, "Oh, can we come down and play?" And I'm like, "Yeah." Of course, you know, so it's like they know the history of the band. People in New York know the history of the band. You know, the reason we continue to stay in Boston, I really think is because of the music. I can't imagine what it would be like without. I can't imagine it would be a drag, you know, because there's a lot of soul searching that goes on when we're playing. And it just makes it easier to play other musics too.
And it's kind of a magical group. Like, it has this magic about it. There's two groups to me that have this just otherworldly chemistry. The Paul Motion had a group with Frizzell and Lovano, and then the Fringe. And they're very different, but in terms of an internal rapport, like the Fringe is, you just couldn't imagine the group with a different bass player, a different drummer. And the things they would do week in and week out. Like, it's like religion for the students. Like, the students just all flock to this thing. Mm-hmm. And it's just incredible the kind of things that they would do, and how the music also, too, is like, you know, it has evolved a lot. You know, it has changed a lot. But just incredibly magical to watch that kind of spontaneous creation. And I guess the other thing for me that's really important about this group is, even though it's a free group, in quotation marks, no one can see me doing free group, even though it's a free group, all these guys can play changes, play forms, they know tunes, they know the tradition. And that to me is really the linchpin that separates them from a lot of other free jazz bands, because they can go and play Body and Soul and then just go ballistic, you know, Pet Shop on Fire. Whereas when a group that's just people who have just only ever played unstructured music, they don't bring the same set of tools to the table. Like, these guys used to do this thing where they would play a ballad, and we would all say, "Well, what tune was that?" They would just make it up, They would just make up a ballad, like, let's play a ballad. But it wouldn't be, they would just, the bass player would just follow George around. And it sounded like a tonal tune. It had it had an A section and a bridge, and it'd go to the four chord at some point.
Like, you can almost remember the words.
Yeah. And we'd all look at each other like, the kids would be like, what tune are they playing? And George, what tune was that? I don't know. We just made it up.
The big thing about all of that is that Lockwood, you know, the bass player, he had unbelievable ears, like, unbelievable ears. And when he first came into the group, he was always on me about, oh, George, where do I go? Where do I play? John, just play, you know? And it took him a long time to get over the fact that what he and I were doing weren't the same thing. And then once he gave in, you know, I told him, I said, it's not an issue. Just let it go. And then once he let go, we locked even.
But it's also back and forth too. Like, George, it's not just a one-way street. Like, John will set stuff up and George will play on it, and then he'll play over top of it, and then he'll come back into it and then play over top of it again. So it's a two-way street. But John is really a remarkable bass player.
Yeah, it's just interesting because I don't know. It's unexplainable. You know, it's like, you want to keep a relationship together, don't try. You want to keep a band together, don't try. Don't pressurize these guys. We never talk about the music. We barely talk to each other. It's great. I mean, you've known someone for 45 years. It's like you go by the vibe, you know, like just, I mean, you talk about things, but, you know, don't try to get analytical about why is it doing this or doing that. It's just doing what it's doing. And then every week is different.
But you do seem to have an ability to ferret out someone's resistance and then try to break it down.
I'm the king. I can break
it. It's like a great challenge for you.
No, it's like, all right, first of all, these guys come in. Now I have high-level players. It's always been that way. These kids can go neck and neck with you. They can play Giant Steps. They can play Countdown. They can play all the tunes that are really, you know, challenging. So I had, for me, I had to figure out what I could do to go above their level of playing. And that's when I fell on this triadic approach. I mean, I'm saying to these kids still to this day, and I teach the triadic approach in a master's program at the Global at Berkeley. And, you know, can you play major triads with half step in between and don't repeat the inversion? And they can't do it. You know, and I'm talking about really high level players, because the whole thing is about non-repetition, and no one's ever taught them how to be non-repetitive. And that's what I'm doing with this in this chromatic approach. I mean, the other day I was mystified. It still mystifies me because how it came from me. You know, I'm really just a street guy. And, you know, it's like how it's decided who does this and who does that. Like, I had them playing All the Things You Are in between a major third. So you have, you know, half step, whole step, minor third, major third. Don't repeat any of the intervals, like two half steps. And they were falling on the floor that you could play that song inside of a major third. And I'm like, damn, I'm glad this works. You know, and these kids were like, oh. And there was more resolution inside that major third than there was the whole gamut of the 12-tone row. I mean, if you understand music out there, but
it's amazing, you know, from a world of academics, like all of Boston and Cambridge, academic, you know, making artificial plans for everything. You just lived it and then wrote it down on a chalkboard.
But there's, you know, like I said before, in your life, there's got to be one person that says, hey, it's okay to play wrong. And that's me, you know. I mean, a lot of people really probably don't agree with what I'm saying, but I want you not to agree, because you'll walk out and say, like, wow, what the hell is this guy talking about? But there's something in there that, you know, causes curiosity. And then, like, I had to figure it out from the scholastic end. You know, I had to be able to get up there and say, look, okay, here's the sound and here's how it goes. And for these high-level rocket scientists that I deal with at the school, you know, these kids, they know everything, they play everything, you know, they're like, okay. And then I come along and say, like, okay, play all the things you are in between the major third, and they're like, okay. And then they do it in the hearing resolution. This is what people need to see to understand that music can be a lot looser than it is. I mean, when I presented this to the master's accreditation board at Berkeley, I had to tell them, look, these guys, you know, if you're hip to music, these guys can play bebop. Bebop is like secondary. It's like, you know, learning how to eat when you're young or walk. These kids can do this. So you need to give them something that's completely over their head. And they went for it. And, you know, I mean, I've been teaching this since Andrew was at NEC, so I knew it would work. I just needed to convince them.
You know what? We have about 5 minutes left in this hour of music, mostly conversation in this case, fascinating conversation. I'd like to thank George Garzón for coming to WMUK on busy festival weekend. And Andrew, thank you so much for bringing your former teacher here and sharing him with Kalamazoo audiences. I'll bet you can tell when an audience isn't quite prepared for free jazz. What do?
I prepare them. The best thing is don't prepare. Come in unprepared, you know. You want to be naked when you listen to music like this. This way, you know, you don't have any covering on and I can see you.
Would you set this up for us, final tune?
This is from a record called The Fringe Live at Zeitgeist, and this is the last track on the record, which is a tribute to George's favorite football team, the vaunted New England Patriots.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.